School districts across the country have been struggling to cope with increasing school lunch debt. This hour, new policies to avoid lunch shaming. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lunch shaming, practices that can humiliate children in public schools who have unpaid lunch debts. We'll talk about new federal policies to address student lunch debt with Ann Feilman of Iowa's Department of Education and State Senator Michael Padilla of New Mexico, where that state passed his Hunger-Free Students Bill of Rights Act. Then Grinnell College President Raynard Kington will join us live as we continue our back-to-school conversations with Iowa University and college presidents. That's coming up. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Perhaps you remember these news stories having to do with our first half-hour topic from recent years. In 2015, a cafeteria worker from Colorado made national headlines when she claimed she was fired after feeding a first grader who didn't have lunch money. There was the other story of a worker in Pennsylvania. A school worker there quit after she had to take away hot meals from two students. Well, school districts across the country have been struggling to cope with increasing school lunch debt. Their responses to kids with school lunch debt have been all over the map. Some provide the kids with an alternative lunch, perhaps a cold cheese sandwich. I talked to my son this morning, who's in high school. He says, I think that's what they do at their school. Other schools sometimes provide a hot lunch, but require students to do chores, other methods, a child's hand gets stamped or they get a wristband showing that they're behind in payment. And some schools, though, will deny the students lunch altogether. Lunch shaming is a term that gets used in this discussion. Lunch shaming, practices that can humiliate children in public schools who have unpaid lunch debts, such as just dumping that student's lunch in the trash once they get to the cash register. We want to hear from you this first half hour. Parents, do you have a story to tell about how your child was treated for unpaid school lunch debt? Or perhaps you yourself were treated differently as a kid in school because of unpaid lunch debt. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Joining us this first half hour, Ann Feilman, Bureau Chief for Nutrition and Health Services at the Iowa Department of Education in our Des Moines studio. Hello, Ann.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Also, Michael Padilla is with us, I assume, from New Mexico. He's a New Mexico state senator. Senator Padilla, welcome.
Thank you very much for taking an interest in what we're doing here in New Mexico. Thank you for having me on.
We'll talk about some legislation that you authored that passed in New Mexico that's kind of at the forefront of this problem, addressing this problem. But first, Ann Feilman, let's talk about the USDA's new requirements requiring districts to adopt policies for addressing meal debts. For instance, informing parents at the start of the academic year, what is now required from the U.S. Department of Agriculture?
For schools participating in National School Lunch Program, they're required to have a written policy of how they will handle the situation where a child doesn't have money in their account, or cash in hand, or they're not eligible for free meals. They also need to have a plan that they will provide this this policy to the households in their district.
Mm-hmm. And so what has been your role in seeing this? It's been July 1st that this new federal requirement went out. Is there a statewide response or way, or what are you telling school districts?
Because each district is different in their administration, their population and things, it's a local decision on how they make this policy. But our role is to help them frame the discussions that they need to have as they develop these and things that they need to make sure that they're considering as they go down the path and decide how they want to respond.
Mm-hmm. So what are you telling them? What are the options that you're seeing out there based on your recommendations?
The basic decision they have to make is, are they going to offer an alternative meal or not? I've heard, both ways and stuff, but our guidance to them is, strong outreach to families that are nearing zero, that still have a little money in the account but are nearing zero. We also encourage them to arrange their serving line so that the cashier is at the beginning of the line, so before a student starts to select food items and things. Notification of the student if they've reached the point where there will be some ramifications away from the cafeteria and before lunch if possible. And just to two other things, to do what all they can. We work very hard to identify students that are qualified for free meals or reduced price meals through direct certification. We provide that information twice a month. And then for them to have all the players involved in the conversation on how they want to handle it.
Mm-hmm. Of the various ways that schools across the country have been dealing with it, when I listed those at the start of this conversation, do we see all those examples in Iowa, dumping lunches that have already been collected and at the cash register, all the way to just saying no, or alternatives, or even chores around the school to earn your lunch, so to speak? Have we seen all of those?
No. We, for a long time in Iowa, have provided the guidance that offering a meal as payment for work is not acceptable, no matter what their balance is, because it results into payment that's not equal. If you have a student who is eligible for reduced price meals doing work for a meal versus someone who isn't and is at a paid status, they're really receiving different income at that point. So that's longstanding been guidance that we've offered. If they're going to hire student workers, hire them and pay a wage.
Mm-hmm. Do the recommendations from the Iowa Department of Education depend on the age of the student?
Our recommendations don't, but that is something that I know districts talk about, and levels of responsibility as students get older.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So give us the school district sort of side of the story, this growing lunch debt problem that some systems are facing. How many school districts in Iowa have this sort of debt, and how large are these debts, to your knowledge?
We don't gather data on that specifically, so I only have anecdotal information and what I've read in the paper and things. And I know that one district reported, upwards of, I think, 60,000 as their negative balances. And in a prior position, I was a food service director in a school district, and we saw it increase dramatically over a 5-year period.
What's driving that up? Do you have any idea?
I don't. Mm-hmm. I truly don't.
Mm, okay. So when you're a school district with $60,000, $80,000 in school lunch debt, unpaid debt, you of course try to get that money some way rather than be out of it. Isn't it, I don't know how much you know about the school's budgets, but can they move around money to cover this debt? How are they dealing with it?
No, in Iowa, it's not allowed to move general fund money from the school district into the nonprofit school food service account.
Mm-hmm. So how are schools getting along with a $60,000 or $80,000 debt? Where is that money coming from?
Well, that's why they're pushing very hard to collect these negative balances, because it otherwise impacts their ability to do the program, to hire labor, to pay for foods, all of that.
Mm-hmm. What do you understand to be the reason for children not paying? I mean, how much of this is really students and their families not having the money, or and how much of it is they just neglected to sign up for these free or reduced lunches, and perhaps, or just parents neglecting to put money on their child's account?
Well, we don't really collect those statistics either. We do work really, really hard to have methods available for people to identify students that qualify for free meals that don't require the parents to do an application. I mentioned our direct certification. We match students in our database with a database from Department of Human Services for programs such as food assistance, family improvement program, and foster, and we're able to directly certify those students for free meals. So we try to stop any gaps or people falling through the cracks that way. And we offer also a system called eLookup that if they have a new student, they're able to check that first, and immediately, if they can, get them on qualified for free meals without having to wait for an application to come in. So we try. We do it twice a month. The requirement is once every 3 months, but we've found it beneficial to do it on a twice-a-month basis.
Mm-hmm. Ann Feilman is with us, if you've just joined us, Bureau Chief for Nutrition and Health Services at the Iowa Department of Education. We're talking about the school lunch debt problem across the country, also here in Iowa. The USDA now requiring districts to adopt policies for addressing meal debts and to inform students at the start of the academic year. All these recommendations, these new guidelines, requirements are being sort of interpreted on a local level, as Ann has been explaining. Let's talk with Michael Padilla, New Mexico State Senator, joining us by phone. Earlier this year, the New Mexico legislature passed what was called the Hunger-Free Students Bill of Rights Act, which I believe, Senator Padilla, you authored.
That's right. You know, thank you very much. You also worked very closely with an organization called New Mexico Appleseed. They're a food security and anti-poverty group here in New Mexico. They did a great job of doing some of the research for me and actually drafted the original bill, and we did a couple of things to it, and we put it got into some pretty good shape. You know, I grew up in extreme poverty, and I think, you know, coming from that experience as a child, I was really shocked to find out, I just turned 45, I was shocked to find out that this was, you know, still a thing here in this country and in New Mexico where I live. And so, you know, grew up in foster homes, the all-faiths receiving home for homeless children, and a couple of different family members helped to raise me along the way. And when I found this out, I did end up opening a very nice business and have created a lot of jobs, but I was just shocked to find out that in the richest, most powerful nation on the planet, we're not feeding our children lunch in some cases, or shaming them in the lunchroom, or giving them a cold piece of cheese and a piece of bread. And I know that folks in the school districts, their hearts are in the right place. They're trying to do everything they can with the budgets that they have. But at the end of the day, a six-year-old child has no power whatsoever to eliminate the school lunch debt that they may have. And so we brought this legislation in 1 year. We're able to get it through the legislature. It was very difficult in the beginning when I first introduced the bill because, well, what is a Bill of Rights to begin with? We haven't really, you know, we don't do a lot with that term much, you know, these days. But, you know, when you think about it, the child's hunger really has their focus on their stomach rather than their studies. And so it was really a difficult task in the beginning to get, you know, my fellow senators and then, you know, as you know, in the legislative process, we have to go through both chambers and then get a signature by our governor. And so it was really just it was a really big hill to climb, but we were able to get it done in 1 year. The legislation essentially calls for every child to receive the same, you know, a five-star lunch, if you will, if you can call a cafeteria lunch a five-star lunch, and they're very good. But so you know, they have to make sure that every child has that lunch now. The motivation really becomes on the front end, as the professional from Iowa just spoke of, you know, to get the child on the free and reduced lunch program or some other, you know, methodology to make sure that we validate, first of all, that the child is eligible for the free and reduced lunch and that the school has a more regular flow of revenue and income to that school. If you're chasing down 100, 200, I have the largest high school in New Mexico right now, Atrisco Heritage Academy High School, has 2,800 kids in it. So I'm guessing there's 400 to 500 kids that are, you know, have some sort of lunch debt at that school. And so as a result, if we don't get them on the free and reduced lunch program, the school's, you know, running in circles trying to collect that money, whereas if their motivation and their drive were on the front end to get the child qualified, if they're eligible for it, on this free and reduced lunch, they'd have more regular income and regular flows of monies to the schools to manage that program.
It sounds like more outreach does reduce the amount of unpaid debt here. But did your legislation or anything in the legislature there in New Mexico address there is going to be a shortfall, even if you do a better job? It sounds like to me, even if you do a better job of getting people signed up for free and reduced lunches and so forth and better outreach, what about that shortfall that the school systems have?
Well, we have asked the school districts to project what they believe is going to happen after the first year so that we can work with them from a funding standpoint at the state level. But here again, the issues that they're running into right now, if the motivation is on the front end to make sure that the child that should be on the free and reduced lunch program is getting that eligible benefit, then the likelihood it actually is the revenue to the schools is actually going to go up. The remaining debt, those are things that we're going to deal with through the legislature, through the funding model that we go. We have a funding model that's, you know, equal per student, regardless of where the student goes to school in the state. And so as a result, we believe that that's going to be the model that will be affected as the schools continue to have some of this debt.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing about this legislation is we built in a process that, you know, you have to qualify for this through a state level requirement as well as the USDA free and reduced lunch program. So you really can't game the system either. So if you find out, boy, you know, the school's just feeding everybody, well, you know, if you're eligible for that, then that's wonderful. If you're not eligible for that, those children will, you know, have to continue to pay for their lunch.
Under the heading of lunch shaming, what did you find you were shocked by going on in New Mexico schools that this act is supposed to end?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll just take you back to my childhood as an example. So I was raised by my sisters there at the end. And so as a result, you know, we were incredibly poor. We didn't know where our next meal at the home was going to come from. That might be the best meal that a child, myself, or even another child was able to get during the, you know, during their day, if they're in extreme poverty, the way I grew up. And so, you know, I was required to, you know, mop and clean the tables and put up the chairs, break down the tables, work in the cafeteria, this and that. And I really didn't see it as shaming, you know. It kind of built character in me. But I knew that I was very different from the other children. I knew that I was the poorest kid there. And that, you know, for me, it didn't really, you know, necessarily affect me. But my brother, you know, it absolutely affected him. It absolutely caused him issues in his life. And so that's one example from one family. You know, today what I come to find out is the children are being stamped on their arms, you know, I need lunch money, and they're having to go through the rest of their school day with that. And that is just completely shameful. It also is going to have some, I'm guessing, some sort of behavioral health, you know, effect on these children as well. And, you know, at the end of the day, I want the kids to be able to be a kid in the lunchroom and socialize and develop the social skills that they're going to need for life. And then also, you know, we have, you know, pretty severe poverty rates in New Mexico, which have led to severe dropout rates in our public schools. And so as a result, I believe this is going to have a positive impact on our graduation rates, which will help build a more qualified workforce, which will eventually help to turn around the New Mexico economy.
Mm-hmm. My understanding, Senator Padilla, is that you were overwhelmed with some calls about this bill from lawmakers in other states. Because you're really at the cutting edge of trying to solve this problem, aren't you?
Well, I thought that we were solving a problem here in New Mexico, and I was very happy to do that. I had, you know, I would say I've had a little over 31,000 calls, emails, Facebook messaging, you know, you name it.
And 31,000 people reaching
31,000 of cafeteria service workers just letting me know about their stories, individuals who grew up the way that I did, other legislators, federal elected officials, et cetera. We've had 36 states now reach out to me for our version of the bill. And I know that more specifically, I'll give you an example. The bill in Texas, the bills in Texas and Oklahoma, which are our neighboring states, they're almost an exact mirror of our bill. So 36 other states, excuse me, are going to introduce some form of this bill. I also want to give kudos to our federal delegation. Representative Michelle Lujan Grisham, Senator Tom Udall, and Senator Martin Heinrich have banded together, and they took my bill, drafted into a federal piece of legislation, and we'll be introducing it there. I'm really happy that USDA has done what they've done, but even if you have that policy or whatever documented and in place, you know, you're still going to run into the issue. And so I just think, again, a 6-year-old, 8-year-old, all the way up to, you know, 12, 14-year-old has really no power of resolving this issue. So why are we penalizing them when it's the parent or the guardian or someone else that's responsible for that debt?
Mm-hmm. We have just a few minutes left. Ann Feilman, I wanted to get back to you of the Iowa Department of Education. A comment on this, if you had this. The Trump administration has said it wants to remove what it calls burdensome regulation on school lunches. A plan to delay a mandate that would require schools to further reduce sodium levels in the meals that are served at our schools. The administration wants to give the green light to schools that want to serve some grains that aren't whole grain rich, this under Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue. Is any of that coming down? Do you know what's happening? Are you following that?
Yes, actually, the whole grain exemptions. So we've offered those, been able to offer those for a couple years, and it's in keeping line with the first level of 50% whole grain rich grains, so allowing some that aren't. The sodium would be not advancing it to a more restrictive level, maintaining the what is a, you know, beginning healthy level of sodium as well. And so we're seeing some of that. And
so you are seeing some relaxing of federal regulations since President Trump has been in office?
Yes, it's continued. We have seen some of those exemptions with the whole grains prior to this year as well. So it's continued, and I believe they're working to make it a more permanent feature of the program, but those are doable.
Mm-hmm. And when you look into the future, what do you see as the challenges on this front as far as the back to the school lunch debt problem? What are you going to be seeing as challenges in the coming weeks and months?
It does get back to household payments. In looking through the bill from New Mexico and things, there's not any additional motivations for the parents or guardians to keep meal accounts current. And I think especially in Iowa, with not being able to transfer those funds, that would be an important aspect. So, the question is, where will the money to bridge that gap for unpaid meals come from?
Right. Senator Padilla in New Mexico, do you have an answer to that? Are you looking at perhaps some follow-up legislation?
Well, I'm not sure that I agree with that, you know, completely. At the end of the day, if you're required to pay for the school lunch that are eligible for your child or for your child, you still have to do that. None of that goes away. And so I'm not quite sure why the motivation wouldn't be there, because now the school's going to be, you know, a little more focused on, again, getting the child who really should be on the free and reduced lunch program established and set up that way, whereas the other debt continues that way. And if they're able to pay that for that lunch because they're not eligible for the free lunch, then I think the school will be a little more successful in collecting, you know, debt from people who can actually pay it.
Okay.
Instead, today they're chasing down children and families that just can't pay it, and so I think they're probably utilizing some of their time and energy in the wrong direction.
Okay,
help them.
Let's end it with this tweet. One of our listeners, Slayton, tweets. He was raised, or he or she, I imagine it's a he, Slayton, was raised in poverty. My mother never turned anyone away from the table. Raise my taxes. Never deny a child lunch. Period. That's a tweet. thanks for that input from our listener. Ann Feilman, Bureau Chief for Nutrition and Health Services at the Iowa Department of Education. Michael Padilla, State Senator in New Mexico. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, a live conversation with Grinnell College President Raynard Kington as we continue our back-to-school conversations with Iowa University and College Presidents. President Raynard Kington after this short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As students head back to campus for the fall semester, we always like to check in with Iowa's university and college presidents to discuss the challenges they're facing. Last week, if you listened to this program, we heard from University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld. Today, we have the president of Grinnell College, Raynard Kington. He is beginning his 8th year as the head of this prestigious school in Grinnell, Iowa, consistently ranked among the top liberal arts colleges in the country. President Kington, welcome back to our program.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Seems like only yesterday. I can't believe you're beginning your eighth year. We spoke first in your first year.
Yes.
And so it's going very quickly. Let's talk about a few things that you're shaping there at Grinnell College. Zone of Confluence. Tell us about that. It's an initiative to create a sort of a stronger bridge between the campus and downtown. What is it?
So as we were thinking about how we could position the college to be a success in the future, the bottom line is that it became increasingly clear that we would only be successful if the town was also successful, that our futures were deeply tied. And we've known this, but it became clear that in order for the town to be even a better place to live, that the college would have to be more involved. And it occurred to us that there was this sort of one or two block stretch between the downtown of our small town and the campus, and that it was sort of a dead zone. There weren't a lot of businesses, and it was a barrier for our students and faculty to go downtown and for people downtown to come onto campus. And we have lots of open events on campus. So we decided that we were going to start working with the town to develop that area, but also to increase our sort of footprint in the town. So, for example, we are having a major new building, humanities and social studies complex, $120 million complex. And as a result of that, we had to tear down our bookstore. Well, we moved our bookstore downtown. Now, that may not seem like a long distance of 4 or 5 blocks, but in a small town, 4 or 5 blocks is a long distance. Mm-hmm. And so we've been thinking of all sorts of ways that we can deeply connect to the town, including finding ways to pull our students and our faculty to use the businesses and resources in the town and for town members to feel welcome on our campus.
Is that also due to a reaction or some feedback, I don't know, criticism you might call it, is that you going to Grinnell that people would wish to feel more part of the town, that they feel like they're separate as a student there?
Well, I don't know if we've had a gradual increase in terms of how the college has been connecting. We have my predecessor, the President Osgood, had really worked really hard to improve our relationships. So we were sort of on an upward trend, and this just takes it to the next level. It is true, though, that I think in the last year, particularly since the presidential election, that we're thinking a lot about how we can do a better job connecting with the communities that surround us. We think that we're an interesting institution in that we are a first-rate liberal arts college, known for being very progressive, dating from our founding by abolitionists. But as a result of where we are, we're sort of right at this intersection between two different American visions in a lot of ways. And we think that's a good thing, that enriches students' educational experience by exposing them to communities and people that they might not even be exposed to if they went to college in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. You use the phrase, especially since this last election. Why would that spur this integration between the campus at Grinnell College and the town?
Well, I think in many ways there was a lot of conversation and continues about the last election, certainly the campaign, even before the actual election, was an extraordinarily divisive campaign, and with the change in leadership, we're a pretty divided country. I would argue that we're more divided now than I can ever remember in my adulthood, certainly. So I think it's natural for colleges and institutions of learning and knowledge to think, okay, what is it, what's happening now? And we have lots of ideas about that, but I agree that the campaign and the election sort of brought to the fore these tensions among different groups of people in this country. And we're this sort of, I wrote an op-ed actually for the Washington Post about this, we're this sort of blue bubble in a red state. And some see that as a disadvantage. I see that as an advantage because we're right at the intersection of these different worlds. And there are lots of dimensions. We're very diverse institution, 25% domestic students of color. We have a lot of low-income students. We have students from all over the world, 20% international. So we're that, very diverse institution, yet our county, I think, is like 90-something percent white. And we're in a rural county. So there are many ways we're at the intersection of all these different parts of this country.
Mm-hmm. You talked about divisions in this country being so great, perhaps not greater than never before, any greater. Do you include racial divisions in here, certainly, because of our national conversation over the last few months, last few weeks?
No, absolutely. I think many of us in higher education were astounded by what happened in Charlottesville, which is the home of the first institution of higher education to really embrace a liberal education with a small L, liberal education, sort of liberal arts type education, and to have that be the site of this horrific event was troubling to so many people in education. We're in higher ed, we're about knowledge, and we really believe that the sort of bigotry and racism and intolerance sort of reflects ignorance, and that knowledge is the answer to those divisions. But now we have to sort of work at that. I think there's a lot of criticism of our community of higher education as not being part of the solution. In fact, some people think we're part of the problem in lots of ways, and I don't agree with that. But I do think that we have to have hard conversations with ourselves and our communities about what role we play as these special institutions in our community in helping this country heal.
Mm-hmm. In the wake of that violence, the injuries, the one death in Charlottesville, I guess now over 2 weeks ago, did that prompt you in the administration at Grinnell College to review campus protest policies, change them, make sure that mm-hmm. what happened in Charlottesville would not happen here in Iowa?
Well, we did. Even before the events in Charlottesville, we had been drafting, based on a lot of conflict that happened on campuses last year, a restatement of our principles about that underlie our policies related to expression, free speech. So we're still in the process of finalizing those, but that had started long before Charlottesville. But Charlottesville didn't just happen. I mean, there was a ramp up of issues and events over the last year or so, many of them accelerating after the election. So I think we certainly are looking, taking a close look at our free speech policies. I think that we are, institutions of higher education are these special places that are supposed to be about a free expression of ideas, even ideas that are intolerant, that seem offensive. We believe that the answer to offensive free speech is more speech.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, let me first remind our listeners, Raynard Kington is with us, president of Grinnell College, live as we go to the university and college presidents throughout Iowa to discuss the challenges at the start of a new school year. President Kington, could you share any of your personal reflections on that violence in Charlottesville and this president's reaction? And because this is radio, I'll just mention that you're Grinnell's first African-American president here. And also, you make do not hide this and shouldn't, of course, that you descend from slaves. Your great-grandparents, I believe, were slaves?
Yes, my great-great-grandparents were slaves. My maternal grandparents were school teachers who were able to go to school as the children of people who were born as slaves. So we have a long family history of both deeply committed to this American ideal of justice and freedom, but also have lived through this horrific history of racial intolerance in this country. So, and the fact that this institution was founded by abolitionists who came out to Iowa because of their deeply held beliefs related to the end of slavery. So, you know, I care deeply about these issues, and I'm not the first person to say that I believe that our current administration has actually made matters worse, and certainly our president has not in any way shown the leadership to help our country get united and to overcome our differences. Quite the contrary, I think his failures in responding to Charlottesville were unambiguous.
Let me. See if you have a response to some criticism that it was aimed at your administration. This is a recent student paper editorial, very critical of Grinnell College administration. If I could just read the first paragraph, which summarizes the criticism from the student newspaper called The Scarlet and Black. This is from the newspaper. editorial. The Scarlet and Black staff finds it necessary to take a firm stance on the events surrounding affirmative action and race that have taken place during the Trump administration. Recent events such as Charlottesville have indicated how racists have become further emboldened in the United States. The Department of Justice's recent decision to divert resources away from civil rights cases towards investigation of race-based affirmative action in college admissions represents harmful policies biased against people of color. Furthermore, Grinnell College's policies regarding affirmative action and race deserve scrutiny, considering administrative silence on both specific measures to replace the Posse. Posse is a New York foundation that helps out with financial aid, I believe, the Posse program, as well as the Department of Justice's efforts to challenge race-based admission policies. I'll end the quote there. Plenty more of it there. But I wonder, if President Kingdon, if you had a comment on this criticism.
First of all, I will defend to the end their right to say something I disagree with.
All right.
I disagreed with their finding here. And I think this is part of a general problem that we find ourselves in now. So many things that are happening out in the public domain that are just so disturbing to many of us. And the question is, how do you respond? And to be honest, at a time when sort of what you say seems to mean less and less, I think what you do is much more important. The fact is that we have our incoming class has retained our about 25% domestic students of color, an extraordinary record of diversity for a college in a state that is not very racially diverse. We have a great chief diversity officer. We've increased our staffing, supporting multicultural students in lots of ways. Furthermore, we've worked really hard to make sure that our affirmative action programs meet the Supreme Court standards, which means that it has to be both you have to demonstrate a compelling need and that the program has to be narrowly tailored. We've addressed both of those. So we think that what we're doing is right, and we probably need to give our broader community, including students, an update on what's happening. But I will stand. I have no problem saying that we always have room for improvement. But what we're doing now is incredibly. We are deeply committed to this issue, and I think the problem is that with so many things happening on a regular basis that raise such fundamental issues for matters that colleges care deeply about, such as free speech and social justice. Question is, when do you respond and how do you respond? And the reality is that we've chosen to focus on making sure that we are doing what is right. I've co-signed a few letters. I mean, certainly when the last major challenge came forth to the Supreme Court with the Fisher case from University of Texas, I was among a group of presidents and of universities and colleges who signed an amicus brief that stated unambiguously our commitment to affirmative action. And so we could just say it again and again and again, and maybe we should. I think we need to focus on what we do, and I think that the facts are that we are able to retain and recruit a diverse student body, and we're going to do even more.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to those who may have the perception of affirmative action, not specifically to Grinnell, but to other places, that there are students getting there who are not there based on their merit, but because of affirmative action?
Many of those complaints are based on a failure of understanding how decisions are made about who gets into universities and colleges and what are the essential elements of a university and college education. We believe that an essential element is having a diverse student body in addition to a diverse community of faculty and staff. But we don't believe in our world that we can actually deliver a first-rate higher education experience without a diverse student body, one. Two, we also have always looked at a range of different variables that help us decide whether there's a good fit for a student in the college. And the fact is, we simply would not admit students that we didn't think were able to withstand the academic rigor of our institution. The fact is, we have last year we may have had 7 or 8 applicants for every seat that was coming forth. So we had to make tough decisions, but we absolutely, I have no problem defending our admissions process and also absolutely standing by our commitment to assuring diversity. We think it is not something you do after you do everything that's important. We think that it's integral to the educational experience at our college, and we cannot provide a first-rate education if we don't have a diverse student body.
We have about 5 minutes left of this live conversation with President Raynard Kington of Grinnell College. Let's talk, your diversity, you've explained that in depth. Tuition and fees for 1 year, looking that up, over $50,000 per year. I don't think that includes room and board. More than $250,000 for a four-year undergraduate degree. How does Grinnell make that affordable for diverse economic backgrounds?
So again, I think we do a great job with regard to access. So every year it's noted that Grinnell has the highest tuition in the state. Absolutely true. What is less known and less publicized is that our students have the lowest average debt in the state of Iowa, including substantially lower than the average graduate's debt at UNI, Iowa State, and University of Iowa. So how does that happen? We give an extraordinary amount of financial aid. We admit students without regard to financial ability to pay. We meet all of demonstrated need. If you look through, there have been, over the last several years, a number of reviews by the New York Times, and we're always highly ranked as one of the schools that has had the most aggressive programs for financial aid for students. The average student at Grinnell, and this is an important point here, the fact is that even our list price is that, what really matters is how much you pay out of pocket, how much of is given back. And our discount, the amount that we give back to students in terms of free aid, is still over 50%, between 50 and 60-something percent of the fee we basically write off in the form of financial aid. We're able to do that because we have a large endowment, and we're committed to figuring out how we can continue to do that. But I will take on any college in Iowa, any university in Iowa, and the vast majority of universities and colleges in this country when it comes to financial access. We actually put our money where our mouth is.
What is the average student debt?
I think it's around 18 to 20,000, I think, is the average debt.
Upon graduation.
Upon graduation. So that means that's for students, about 30% of our students receive sufficient aid in the form of grant, not loan, to cover their tuition. So that means about 30% of our students have free tuition.
Well, according to the U.S. Department of Labor, private college tuition is rising faster than inflation, President Kington. In a proposed budget for the 2018 fiscal year, President Trump proposed a cut in financial aid for students. So I wonder, are these repercussions, this proposal, still at a proposal stage, is that having repercussions already there in Grinnell College? Are you hearing from families, students about this? Are you making determinations on Grinnell's tuition based on what looks like a cut to financial aid for students?
Well, colleges like Grinnell will be less impacted, but still impacted than many of our peer institutions. And I think it would be devastating to cut back on financial programs, loans, and grants that allow students with lesser means to provide access to a first-rate education like Grinnell. It would be devastating. We already have a tremendous problem with social mobility in our society. I think there are a small number of elite liberal arts colleges, Grinnell, Amherst, Pomona, that really had remarkable improvements in access. But the vast majority of the students don't go to schools like Grinnell that have over half our budget every year comes directly from our endowment. Mm-hmm. We don't even pass on those costs.
So your endowment is in the how many billions now?
I think it's like $1.8 billion.
$1.8 billion.
So we have a large endowment that allows us to do things. So we would be impacted, but we wouldn't be impacted nearly as much as a lot of other schools. And the bottom line is not the schools that we care about, it's the students. And I think students at a time when we have extraordinarily increasing economic inequality in this country, at a time when higher education remains the major engine of social mobility, to pull back on commitment to provide resources to students would be shameful.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left, President Kington. Leave us with something you're excited about on your campus or happening there at Grinnell College, a bright spot. We've been talking about a lot of serious challenges this half hour.
You know, the best thing that that keeps me going is welcoming a new class of students every year. We have this incredible group of students who came to us, started last week, 450-something, almost every state, 20% of out of the country, and we also give some aid internationally, so they weren't just wealthy international students. We have students from around the globe. We have extraordinary students who are committed to changing their lives and the lives of other people. Seeing them helps me through the difficult days, and that's why all of us are here, to provide opportunities for students so they can go out and change their lives and the lives of other people.
Okay, thank you. Raynard Kington, president of Grinnell College. I hope when we talk again, we'll be able to talk about a prize that you started back in 2010, the Grinnell College Innovator for Social Justice Prize. We didn't get to that today. I hope we will in the future, President Kington.
Next time.
All righty. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Raynard Kington, president of Grinnell College. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Ben Stanton with help from Helena Thompson. Tomorrow on the program, what an interesting program. We'll be talking about the science of engineering humans, making us inside the science of the engineered human, the bodybuilders. We'll have the author of that book on tomorrow on this program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.